From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, San Antonio at its tricentennial, what global and local forces defined and shaped the city at its founding and still today. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. 300 years ago, San Antonio was a military outpost beyond what was known. It was put in a place called the New World, a place that was far away, unexplored, and uncertain. It was founded and settled to prove to the old world that this land belonged to Spain. And over the next three centuries, the city would change hands and flags multiple times, with the fate of Texas hanging in the balance. Today, San Antonio is the seventh largest city in the nation and one of the fastest growing cities in America, and it continues fighting some of the same old battles over water, political power, poverty, and race. Char Miller writes about it in his new book, San Antonio, A Tricentennial History.
San Antonio, distant though it was also a place of great conflict, horrendous conflict, actually, up through the 19th century. And so it was at once a frontier space, and that was problematic unto itself, but also a place over which, despite the fact that it was off the map, people fought over in pitched battles in various ways. And the Alamo is just one of many of those battles and conflicts. And I think, you know, it may have been on another zone, but it turns out that human beings were really interested in that zone. And I would add a third or maybe fourth character to the story, which was the land itself. The land as an actor in the way in which human beings dealt with it, the water flows that were essential to survival there from the Payaya forward in time, and managing those resources or controlling them was also part of why people were fighting over this tiny little town, far removed from the Spanish Empire and right in the path of the Lipan Apache and the Comanche and others.
But as you talked about San Antonio being an outpost for the Spaniards, as they wanted to preserve the map, you know, they had to prove to the Pope in Europe that they were definitely doing something with this land and they could claim it as their own. And so originally San Antonio was a military outpost. San Antonio calls itself Military City, USA. It has trademarked that expression. Many people, when we talk about, hey, San Antonio, Military City, USA, they think about the military as it is today, but actually it goes to the very beginnings.
The very beginnings, and it, you know, it's beautifully demonstrated in the first moment when the first entrada, the first expedition shows up in the city, in which they're bristling with arms. And they're seeing this as a place not only to pacify the people who were here, but also to display weaponry, which is a way of showing that you have the capacity to do violence on others, and you will use that violence to control it. I mean, the irony for me, and it's not much of an irony, it's really this beautiful through line of the 300 years in which the city claims as its tricentennial, is that the military really built the city. It was the first to figure out why it should be built there, and it still remains this powerful force in shaping the life ways of the community. And although that has diminished after the BRAC Commission, you know, started diminishing the military's presence, but we still occupy the land and utilize those now closed bases in new ways, but those are old bases, right? So we're literally living on top of the world that the military built for us.
And moving forward after, you know, creation of the Presidio and the fighting for the settlement of San Antonio, it continued to be a battleground for the creation of Texas.
Yes. And I think that's a story that rightly deserves a central place, although maybe not as centralized as we often do it. But I think the catalyst of a city that brought the Spanish to fight it, that brought the Mexicans to fight for it, that brought the Republican forces to fight in opposition to those other entities, is an extraordinary story. It's very rare, and I think it's Frank de la Teja, among others, who has argued that San Antonio may be the most fought over townscape, landscape, in what is now the United States. And that really struck me as I was thinking about it. And then suddenly I could start to see what they were talking about, and sort of crafted parts of the book to sort of reflect that. And even, you know, if we think about World War I, which we think is over there in Europe, San Antonio was deeply involved in that war, as much as it would be with World War II, as an equally in the Korean and Vietnam conflicts. And then the third thing, and it's really crucial, is it wasn't just about training military personnel. It was the tens of thousands of civilian defense workers who went onto those bases starting in World War I and then really accelerated World War II through the conflicts in Korea and Vietnam, and whose lives were fundamentally changed by it. One way to think about this, the military produced San Antonio's middle class.
So I want to go back a little bit more and just sort of flesh out that claim that San Antonio may be one of the most fought over pieces of real estate in the continental United States. Galveston was fought over and Brownsville changed hands multiple times during the Civil War. You know, all these places that were fought over during the American Revolution as well. But you think about the Battle of Medina, Texas independence in the Alamo, but then we also had like the Battle of Salado Creek, when, you know, Mexico comes back into the Republic of Texas, Civil War, minor skirmishes, and a Civil War almost broke out in San Antonio.
That's right. And I think if you look at that sort of early to mid 19th century period, it isn't just that the battles happened. Some of them were horrifically brutal and bloody. I mean, mass murder, effectively, of people who were, quote, prisoners. The slaughtering that took place tells you something about the intensity of emotions. And, I mean, revolutions are not kind. They are times and moments when people's lives are considered expendable. And, my God, the bloodshed at Medina and elsewhere is really kind of unforgettable. And so to think about that, to think about the murder of Unionists in the Hill Country, tells you a lot about not just surging emotions and sort of political ideologies, but that this town, for some set of reasons, as you describe, it's real estate to be sure, but there's something there that really provoked people in terms of how they responded. And that was as true for the conflicts with the native peoples, the indigenous, whether Comanche and Apache, who blew into San Antonio, in which the, you know, gunplay was the sound of pistols cracking and rifles exploding was a pretty normal kind of sound in the 19th century. And it's hard for us to remember that because we got so fixated on the Alamo that we forget that it's part of a larger process. It's part of a larger context in which this city seemed to have sparked so much revolutionary energy and physical violence. And yet the other thing is, and that's the other engagement in the pre-Civil War period, is the Mexican-American War. San Antonio was the staging ground for many of the military incursions from the United States into Mexico. It's been this central player, certainly in the U.S. experience, but equally so for Mexico and the Spanish empires, that to talk about any one of these imperial contexts, San Antonio has to be addressed.
Fort Sam Houston and the establishment of that military post, army post here, was crucial for San Antonio's stability and economic growth and development and creating it as a central location for the state of Texas. It was the main quartermaster post for forts along the border and into West Texas. Before the run-up into World War I, the largest military presence in the United States was along the U.S.-Mexico border, and there was concerns there about our relations with Mexico and whether or not it would become a hot war again. Washington, D.C. always saw San Antonio and Fort Sam Houston as a hedge against another war with Mexico and hostilities with Mexico, which is interesting when we think about where we are today.
Oh, God, yes. I mean, I think if you imagine that borderland stretching from Brownsville to what's now San Diego, and you think about San Antonio's role, at least in the eastern part of that region and landscape. It has always been from a kind of U.S.-centered vision, the place where you hold the line. It was true for Spain and Mexico in a different sense, in a different sort of geography. But note where they built the largest base in San Antonio, Fort Sam Houston. Note where the first airplanes went, which we can say, well, it's climatic because San Antonio, you know, the skies are clear. True. But it could have gone to other places, those first airplanes. But they went to San Antonio. And when the Pershing expedition heads down to punish Mexico and Pancho Villa, where did they leave from? But San Antonio. Where did the National Guard get trained? San Antonio, before they went down. And those airplanes followed suit. The first airplanes used in sort of close support happened there, and in a way that really presaged what would happen in World War I. That's where some of our military leadership and soldiers were first trained for World War I, was in this Pershing expedition that preceded that war. So San Antonio has been at the forefront of lots of different things. And the other thing that I briefly talk about in the book is that when the flood of 1921 happened that just tore apart San Antonio, and there's a whole section of this book that sort of follows floods and flooding, off of Fort Sam Houston flew these airplanes, and they took photographs of what happened. They are using cameras to aerial surveil and assess the damage that then became part of the military strategy thereafter. So even in peacetime, the military in San Antonio was using the city as a way to think through its own strategic initiatives that we would see flourish in the 1930s and obviously in World War II.
Aside from the military richness of your military history point of view, having all of that activity here in this one city, because there was not a massive natural resource here to be mined or to create or to justify, why is there a city in the middle of nowhere in Texas, and why should it become an important location? So the question is, when you look back, some cities are founded and they grow and they become a metropolis, and some cities just fizzle out and they become nothing and they wink out of existence and they fall off the map. Why did San Antonio become the city that it is? And is this the result of forces outside of its control, or is this because of smart public policy? You read the history that you write, and you say, okay, where were the forks in the road, and which way did we go?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I hope we have an hour to answer it. But I think part of the way to think about this is that San Antonio served certain geopolitical needs. For the Spanish, first of all, and for the Mexicans, and ultimately the United States. And it's always contingent. That is to say that its relationship to other places depended upon where it was. And so one could argue that it is the only major city in the state, with the possible exception of El Paso, that actually has a geographical reason for being. It is in a watershed that was absolutely crucial for the Spanish to build their missions and ultimately to fashion a life in South Texas. Houston it's called the Bayou City for a reason. Like New Orleans, it's in a really precarious and vulnerable spot, and yet it has become the nation's fourth largest city. Dallas has no reason for being, and I'm sorry for folks in Dallas, but it's true, but was made to be a city. And San Antonio, because of its environment and its provisioning hub posture, in effect, that it supplied goods and services for the surrounding ranch lands, for example, in agriculture, could limp along in a way through the 19th century without really doing very much, in part because the U.S. military was there, because of its geopolitical importance. And that's why the military, for more than a century and a half, was vitally important in defining what San Antonio was. But that meant that the elite in San Antonio, the power elite, the commercial elite, those who were making money off of the military and agriculture, frankly, they don't have to think large. They don't have to imagine stuff because it's there for them. Where in Houston and Dallas, they had to be a hell of a lot more creative. And so those cities got railroads before San Antonio. One sign of whether your entrepreneurial elite is willing to invest in the city's future was the fact that San Antonio, every time a railroad possibly would come in before we got one in 1877, kind of split down the middle. They weren't convinced it was a good idea for many of them. And, you know, that was not the case in Houston. They had railroads before the Civil War broke out. That's not the case for Dallas. And so some of this is nature gave and we took. Some of this was the military provided, and so we didn't have to think. And some of it is, as you said earlier, kind of missed opportunities and not great public policy. So, you know, it's not until after World War II that in my reading of the city's history, that again, driven by military interests and the extraordinary amount of money that poured into San Antonio during World War II, billions of dollars, World War II, Korea and Vietnam really poured in billions of dollars into the city that enabled the city to not only create the middle class, specifically Latino middle class, but also to begin to imagine, and this is crucial, that you could really build this thing called the Riverwalk and you could get tourists to come because it was a beautiful place and you could sell it that way. But it took a while for that to unfold.
This is Texas Matters. I'm speaking with Char Miller, author of San Antonio, A Tricentennial History. The Riverwalk was an investment in San Antonio. It's a crazy idea, it happened to work. At the very initiation of the idea, plenty of people called it folly. Hemisphere 68, another crazy idea, it just happened to work. A lot of people also were like going, well, this is a nutty idea. But these are public investment ideas that paid off. The city's highway system, one of the first to have this interconnected loop system. And it just seems like when you look back at like, what are the hallmarks, what are the high marks for San Antonio's history? And it's like, this has really paid off. It was public investment projects that worked.
Yes. Yes. And public investment project of a certain kind. So it's actually the Olmos Dam that's essential to the creation of the Riverwalk. Unless you can control floodwaters blasting through the central core, you can't really renovate the river to the point at which Hugeman and others thought it could be done. But it's not until the 1950s and really not until the 1980s when that Riverwalk takes off. But that's public investment that gave hotels incentives to build there, that you build a convention center that would feed those hotels in one way, and those hotels would flush bodies onto the Riverwalk itself, and every restaurant and tourist shop becomes a cash register into which those tourists place their hard-earned dollars. I mean, it's a kind of fleecing, but that's what tourist towns do. But you also invest in rail. You invest in ultimately in rail. So there were four rail lines now coming into San Antonio. You invest ultimately into the interstate highway system, which is actually other people's money. That's federal dollars that are coming in from the gas tax. But, and this is where San Antonio's genius was, is that if the interstate highway system actually creates the loop 410 as we understand it today. And if you look at where the nodes of that highway went, they connect all of the bases. So there's a way in which the National Defense Highway Act, the Interstate Highway System Act of the early of the middle 50s, really depended upon a previous public investment in the military's presence that frankly opened up all of that ranch land to the suburbanization that would explode in the 1960s and 1970s, and then 281 comes in and helps funnel that to the north. 35 comes in as well, and suddenly you have a city that is at the crossroads in ways that had not been, in truth, ever in its history, that links it from Los Angeles to Jacksonville, 35 from Brownsville up to Minneapolis and Duluth, if you want to go to the extremes, 281 that then fans out in different directions. It's kind of amazing the way and the speed with which that happened post-World War II. But again, as you say, it's all predicated on federal dollars, some state and some local monies that pour in, and that changed the landscape of the city and changed it, frankly, to the present.
If we were to have like this crazy existential type of play about San Antonio, and you would have characters moving about on stage, each one sort of representing a part of the forces that shape the city, and then one of them would be a military, a soldier, and one would be water, and then another one would have to be poverty.
Yes. While all of these other things are going on, so you're building dams and you're creating tourism and you've got roadways and you're moving your building blocks of the city out along Interstate 10, so the medical center and UTSA and the like have sort of peeled off and moved them away. What you haven't dealt with and really, truly still have not really acknowledged the degree to which San Antonio was also, despite its wealth, a very poor place. It was very poor in the 18th century. It was very poor in the 19th century, and it remains impoverished relative to other communities in the country. And so, you know, some of that poverty is about education. And, you know, in the 26 years in which I lived in San Antonio and loved it, the central dilemma was always about education, and inaccessibility to good schools meant an impoverishment of classically of neighborhoods that are easy to identify in that way. The tourist dollar, it turns out, does not produce high-paying jobs. It produces low-waged labor, which keeps impoverished the working class of the city. And even though there is, since the 1980s and 1990s, a tremendous number of new jobs, call centers are not unlike tourist traps in which they don't pay a lot of money. We're building more, we're thinking more about these issues, but I think what the most recent analyses of San Antonio's economic standing is there still remains this massive gap between the rich and the poor that you could have identified in the 1930s, which you could have identified in the 1830s, and no doubt back into the 18th century.
The twin character of poverty on the stage would be race.
Yeah, and I think here is where San Antonio is unusual in some ways, that the question of more ethnicity than race, in a sense, because it's always had a very relatively small black population, but has had a very large and to a degree a really influential Latino population from the very beginning, obviously, when this was actually a Spanish/Mexican city. But race, ethnicity, and impoverishment have been deeply ingrained in this city's history and remain so. And I, as I say in the book, it's you know, if we don't fix this by the time we get to the 400th anniversary, we've really failed as a community. And I say we, even though I'm no longer living there, my heart lies in San Antonio deeply. And I live in a city that is also a Spanish city, that has also got tremendous wealth and huge poverty. And so the Southwest generally has these same dynamics, whether it's Phoenix, Tucson, San Antonio, El Paso, or Los Angeles. Many of the pressures are exactly the same. And it is to their shame, I think it's fair to say, that questions of poverty, of education, dispossession, and marginalization of the poor are so consistent as they are.
You do write about some of the characters from San Antonio who have organized, like Ernie Cortez for Citizens Organized for Public Service Cops. He's a recipient of the MacArthur Genius Award, and he helped organize San Antonio West Side church parishes and other groups, South Side, to mobilize and fight for city services.
Yes, and I think that's part of the part of the book that I really loved writing was not only setting the context for why such a thing like Cops and Ernie Cortez needed to happen, but why it happened. And I think part of the why is in response to the decades of disenfranchisement and marginalization. And Ernie was one of many voices that emerged in the post-World War II period that in different ways started to demonstrate how it was possible to organize groups of people who had been so pushed to the side and erased effectively in the city's political life, who then dramatically and brilliantly emerged at a grassroots level through the parishes to begin to dominate the city's life. And when I moved to San Antonio in 1981, it was so exciting to watch that unfold because it was rare in the United States, not unusual, but rare to see that kind of shift in a power dynamic in a very short period of time. So that Cops, would become, for a period of 20 years or so, the dominant voice in the political exchanges in the city, that shaped the budget, that shaped the charter of the city that was torn up and rewritten in support of things that it felt was essential. And as you pointed out, also changed the dynamic on the streets. The term I use in an essay I've written about this is called streetscape environmentalism. It's really looking at the basis, the smallest area, at how we reconfigure the streets, literally by putting sidewalks in and berms, and then channeling that water away from those streets and neighborhoods that had periodically been submerged by flooding. I mean, that's no small achievement. And then to imagine those folks showing up at city council meetings year after year after year, and changing the way in which we talked about politics and who got rights and who didn't, who got access to the budget and who didn't, and how those funds and resources were redistributed, to start to force San Antonio, like other places, to think about the metropolitan whole, not just those who dominated the city by their wealth and status and standing.
As we write and read and talk about history and in the tricentennial, this is an opportunity to dig deep and dive into the story of the city and not just bring up points of trivia, but we're trying to examine how we got here. Is that happening?
Well, you know, I hope the book helps to contribute to that dialogue. I think part of what I've been impressed with in recent trips to San Antonio is that there does... Look, there's a lot of boosterism and celebration, and there should be. It's not every city that gets to 300 years. As you said earlier, there's a whole bunch of cities that have winked out and we don't talk about anymore, have been buried in some form or another. San Antonio is still here. But I think for those who love the city, it would behoove us to have this other conversation, which is, look, let's assess where we are now. And part of the way we do that is to look to the past without blinders on. Let's go dig deep into our history to feel our way through where we have done well and where we have not done so well, and who disproportionately bears the burden of us not doing well. And let's commit ourselves in a forward-thinking, thoughtful, and intentional way to build a different kind of city that actually not just celebrates itself, but also commits itself to transforming its life across the 21st century. The challenges are going to be huge. Poverty still looms large. Climate change will shape and change the dynamics of the physical life that we might lead in a place like San Antonio or Los Angeles or wherever you are in the Southwest. But if we have the deep conversation about where we've been, we can have an equally deep, and I would bet, transformative conversation about where we would like to be in another 100 years, another 50 years. Why not dream that now and build towards it so that it might come to fruition?
Char Miller is the W.M. Keck Professor of Environmental Analysis at Pomona College in Claremont, California. He's the author of San Antonio, A Tricentennial History. It's published by the Texas State Historical Association. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to. And you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas.